From our earliest days, we've gathered around the fire for warmth and comfort. But beyond the light of the dying embers, there is the darkness. And it's in the darkness of the night where we find ourselves, waiting, yearning for the dawn to banish our fears. But our campfire holds more than firelight. For with us, you will hear the tales that make the nightmares engulf you. And you'll dare not close your eyes. Brace yourself for the No Sleep Podcast.
Welcome to the No Sleep Podcast. I'm your host, David Cummings. You know how there's a slang way to say something was really great? Like you go to a show, and when you're asked how it was, you say, "Ah, dude, it was a killer show." When stand-up comedians do a really good set, people say, "They killed." Maybe you do a really good presentation at work, and afterwards a coworker tells you, "You killed it." Isn't it odd how we take the concept of killing something and turn it into something positive? I guess language is funny like that. Almost as funny as when someone actually kills someone else. I pretend murder is funny for horror purposes only. But yes, this is a horror podcast, and so this week we present tales featuring people who see fit to take the life, or lives, of other people. It's hard to imagine what drives someone to do that. It also makes me wonder why we as a society have become so desensitized to it. I mean, for the most part, that is. I'll give you a glimpse behind the curtain here. Over the years, I have received some angry emails from listeners when the content of certain stories upsets them. If you take a look at the trigger warnings we've implemented, they try to warn people about the topics which upset people the most. Things like the death of children or animals. Things like sexual or parental abuse, suicide, all things some people want to be forewarned about. And if they're not, I get angry letters. But I've often wondered, with so many of the stories we've done in the almost 13 years of the show, I've never had anyone upset by a story with a plain old ordinary murder, even when the killing is calculated, cold-blooded, or overly cruel. It seems murder and killing is an accepted part of horror. I suppose that's good for horror creators, but I wonder if it means we as a collective society have become a little too blasé about it. Let me know what you think in the comments below, and don't forget to subscribe and smash that like button. And so, we hope that this episode about killers will leave you saying, "That episode killed." It would be the most fitting response, after all. And now, the sun has set. The fire glows bright. Brace yourself for the darkness of the night. In our first tale, we meet Bobby, a prison guard who has been chosen to flip the switch which will execute a convicted killer. But Bobby is human, after all, and he's conflicted by this assignment. And in this tale, shared with us by author Andrew Punzo, we learn that all attempts to help Bobby deal with this profound task aren't helping his conscience much at all. Performing this tale are Reagan Tacker, Jesse Cornett, Sarah Thomas, Atticus Jackson, and Mike Delgadio. So there may be some ultimate truth out there to contend with, but for now, you have to accept that liars lie.
When Geddy Robinson came into the chamber, he was still screaming that he ain't done a damn thing. About an hour back, his voice had gone hoarse on him, and his eyes rolled all like a wild mare in a thunderstorm. Didn't make my job any easier, but it was really Warden Nast who wasn't helping none.
Liars lie, and killers fry.
He'd said it for about the 20th time through his black hood, nodding as Getty's arms were tethered and the pan with the sponge soaked in brine was strapped to his head. I was sweating through my own hood, suffocating myself in fabric that turned hot and heavy in a second flat. Wasn't just the heat. I never had any qualms with working in a prison. But after we drew matches for the electrocution, I told the warden I had some hesitations.
Now look here, Bobby.
He sat me down in a big leather chair across his desk. The other guards had left, and I was still looking at the headless matchstick, wondering how it was I got there.
Ain't two ways about it. Man's been tried by a jury, full and fair, and his appeal went to the Texas Supreme Court. I even spoke with Les and Trisha at the ACLU, and they said they'd about thrown in the towel on it, too. And you know those folks and me don't always see eye to eye.
I know. I shifted in the chair, sticking to it through my tan prison duds.
Listen, I know you're a Christian man, but this ain't the way you're making it out to be. You ain't throwing a pistol to his head. You ain't sitting down on the beach while he drowns. All you're doing is flipping the switch. Like turning on your kitchen light. That's all it is.
He paused before he said what he swore sideways was in the Bible.
Besides, liars lie and killers fry. Ain't that how it's written?
Getty's legs were bound while three faceless guards held his arms and shoulders. He was a lean fella. Couldn't have been more than 160, no taller than 5'10", mid-50s or thereabouts. But seeing the chair made him superhuman. Must have been 4-5 guards working him over with their billy sticks in the anteroom just to get him through the door. I'd never seen a man put up a fight like that. The day before the execution, I'd gone back into Warden Nast's office. I was feeling sick to my stomach all week.
Can't seem to get on over it, huh, Bobby?
Well, all due respect, Mr. Nast. He says he's innocent. I ain't changed his tune once in all these years. I still don't feel right being the one to pull the switch on him. I mean, ain't that just the same as...
But what Daniel Jennings keeps saying when they couldn't find them girls... Next thing you know, they're pulling him up by the pigtails out of his well. And how about Macy Morganson and all that business about taking the collar and being reformed? And on the eve of parole, he strangles Lessert with the blue flaming rosary?
I remember.
He pulled out a paisley kerchief that was as red as his plum-blooded face.
Well, you do well to remember this, Bobby. Liars lie.
Getty's arm snapped loose from its tethers and something silver flashed from his sock before anyone could get a hold of him. The guard scrambled out of his way and the warden hollered, and I jerked down.
Hold him down.
No less a reflex than the compunction that I felt turning in my belly up to my gullet, hanging down my tubes like a lead snake. Lighting arced and cracked and the loose arm flailed and the clamoring and hollering didn't stop until Getty stopped jiving and the black soot stink of quarter-cooked meat filled the air. The fork that Getty had sharpened down into a shiv lay near Warden Ass's feet, metal tinged with purple and black rings, still coursing with an edge of blue electricity.
Killers fry.
I couldn't sleep that night. And Francine saw I was distressed. I didn't like to talk work with her, but she'd read the newspaper, and the buzz about Getty had been all over town 2 weeks before the paper scooped it.
You ain't done nothing bad now, Bobby.
She rubbed my shoulders above the sheets. I know.
Well, then why can't you rest your eyes?
I know. Every time I closed them, I saw the fork fall into the floor. Dancing live with blue sparks.
Well, maybe you can go see Pastor Dowd sometime this week. He'll set you straight. Not that you need setting. You're as straight as is.
I know.
He was a bad man, Bobby. The fork proves it. Can't you imagine what he would have done with it had you ain't flipped the switch on him?
I don't know. The next morning, I was up before her and walking out on the street. Warden had let me off for the week, pay and all. Normally, I'd have been happy to sleep in, but when I woke near dawn, sleep wouldn't come to me. I wasn't keen on going out, but just lying there thinking was too much. Besides, Francine needed her waitressing uniforms picked up. At first, it was nice to be out of doors, but ours is an early rising town, and more than a few folks passed me by on the street. They knew me, and I knew them, and it seemed they knew what I'd done. The way their heads turned and followed me. The way their eyes lingered on a little too long. They still said hello just the same. There was a heaviness that ain't been there the day before. I felt marked. I felt like how Getty must have felt, walking down the hall to the execution chamber. I pushed the door to the cleaners open and slipped inside, glad to be off the street. I had expected to see Clement behind the counter, someone who could give a left hand about the gossip worming around town. But he wasn't there. Instead, it was a man about my age who I'd never seen before.
Morning.
Morning.
What can I do for you?
Where's Clem?
Out sick. I'm his son-in-law, Jordan.
Are you all right?
You don't want me saying.
I nodded and put my hands on the counter, picking up uniforms from my wife. I handed him the ticket. He went to the mechanical garment rack, working the foot pedal to move the plastic-shrouded clothes along the track. It whirred and the clothes whished as they moved. For a while, that's all there was, other than the silence.
It's the Big C.
Pardon?
Clem. Sick with the Big C.
He's got cancer? The rack stopped moving and Jordan looked down at his foot.
I shouldn't have said nothing. Just been weighing on my mind like you wouldn't believe.
I can believe. He found the uniforms, pulled them off, and placed them on the counter.
$240.
I put up the bills, and while he made change, he looked once more at the ticket and then looked at me.
Your wife, Francine?
Yes.
That makes you Bobby.
It does.
Mind if I ask you something?
I already started to gather up the clothes because I knew I was about to hear something I wouldn't want to.
You're the man who did it on Getty?
I said nothing. My hands felt hot. I wondered why they bothered to make us wear the hoods in the chamber.
I can appreciate that. But I can't make sense of how it's come to be Clem's time so soon when that whoreson takes 16 years to fry.
I turned toward the door, leaving the change on the counter.
I ain't looking for answers. Just been weighing on my mind like you wouldn't believe.
I went straight home and gave Francine her uniforms and stayed indoors for 4 whole days. I tried the television and books and magazines to take my mind off of things. But the images and words just sort of washed over and out of me rather than take on any real meaning. I didn't feel right. Half the time I'd walk into a room and not know why I went in, and the other half I'd find myself in a room and not know how I got there. Francine came and went, but we didn't talk much and I took no calls. On the 5th day I gave up and went to see Pastor Dowd. It was hot and dusty outside, but the church was cool stone, wood, and dulled leaded glass. Me and Pastor said in Our Father, and then I told him what the trouble was. I asked if he'd hear a confession, but he said he wouldn't because that was a matter between me and God, and in any case, I hadn't committed a sin he'd ever heard of. I said I'd feel better if he did anyway. He sighed and afterwards sat me down in his office.
Robert, Getty Robinson was a bad man. A very bad man.
Yes, sir. Warden and my wife says the same, even the ACLU.
Yes. He would have done more bad things. He would have hurt more people. And God only knows how many more. You saw the fork.
Yes, sir. That ain't wrong, and I don't doubt it now. But my point is, I'm having a hesitation I can't get over. I never once wanted to kill a man, even a bad one. But I flipped the switch. And in my way of thinking, that's just the same.
Wait.
He labored mightily over his next sentence.
Do you know the trolley dilemma?
No.
See, my seminary believed philosophy every bit as important as a study of God.
I nodded, not one to speak and ruin the spell that Pastor Dowd would get to working himself into when he gave a good sermon.
It's a moral dilemma, a thought experiment. You're on a trolley that's going down a track, flying down it so fast that up ahead comes quicker than you'd like, and looking to your side, all you see is a blur, and you can't stop because the brake is broken. Now, there's five men working on the track up ahead, and they don't know you're coming because the whistle's broken too. But there's a switch on the trolley, and you have time to hit that switch before you come up on those five men. And if you hit the switch, the trolley goes down a fork in the track where there's only one man working. See, so there's no choice. Morally, you need to hit the switch. Morally, it's the right thing to kill one to save five.
I sat, still and quiet. I took his point and I wasn't confused, but he'd been expecting I would have jumped up and hollered Jehovah like a man who had a coming to moment.
So it's just like you flipping that switch. You had to kill one to save more. No one had fault you for that. There's no moral wrong. You didn't do a bad thing. Matter of it is, you did a good thing. The best thing.
Yes, sir. Warden and my wife says the same.
Never mind the fact that Getty's trolley was a long time coming. You said it yourself that even the ACLU agrees. It's like how your warden over there puts it. Liars lie and killers fry. That's the best five-word summary of the Old Testament as I'll ever hear.
But it ain't in the Old Testament.
Well, no.
You ought to tell that to him. Pastor Dowd shifted uncomfortably and kept looking at me down his nose.
Is there anything else, Robert?
What about jumping?
What's that?
Ain't the whole mess avoided by jumping?
From what?
From the trolley. I ain't much for philosophy. But I'd judge it, you could have just jumped off the trolley in the first instance and solved the whole mess.
The five men would still die, Robert. It wouldn't solve anything.
Sorry, Pastor. I was meaning for the trolley driver. Solves the whole mess for him. He doesn't need to flip the switch and kill nobody, and the trolley just does what it was going to do all along. At least according to your hypothetical. Pastor Dowd's mouth opened, slow and careful like always, but this time no words came out.
How'd the meeting with Pastor Dowd go?
Good.
Well, how are you feeling?
Feeling right as rain. Francine beamed.
See? I knew that would do you well. But that's something I always knew.
I nodded as she stood and began clearing dishes for dessert. When the phone rang and she ran off to the living room, I turned my attention more fully to the fork. I'd been fixing on it all dinner. The last bits of smoked pork were hanging on its tines, tines that I had no trouble bending. I bent all but one and held it up, marveling at the sleek silver shape of it as it flashed in the light like a creek shiner.
So kind for asking. He's doing just fine. Fine. Matter of fact, Warden asked, he'll be even better knowing you had it in your heart to call on him.
I stood and shuffled into the kitchen where the devil's food was cooling on the sill. The pork sat, wet, pink, and charred on the cutting board. Using the shiv, I turned on the light switch and stood looking at the electrical outlet next to it on the wall.
Well, you know him, Warden. You know my Bobby. He's a man of principles. Upstanding is putting at least, Mr. Nast. I'm talking about scruples, about true morality. And he's always been that way. Something these politicians...
Getty got what he deserved. His trolley was a long time coming, and besides that, he was guilty of sin. I closed my eyes and saw blue sparks dancing on the edge of the shiv again, purple and black rings like the space between the stars.
Of course, you're a man who knows a thing or two about morals, Mr. Nast. What's that line you're always saying? Pastor Dowd even used it preaching.
I felt my arm stretching forward. And the Getty smell in the kitchen became heavy and putrid.
Mm-hmm, that's right. Liars lie.
I opened my eyes.
And killers fry.
I flipped the switch.
Don't get fried. It's just a short word from our sponsor. For ad-free extended horror content, go to sleepless.thenosleeppodcast.com. I think it's safe to say that was a well-executed story. But it's not as easy to complete online tasks when you live in Canada and run a company with mostly US-based partners. You might be surprised at how often I get unavailable in your country notices when trying to work. So that's why I'm thrilled we have a new sponsor, Surfshark VPN. We love scary things at No Sleep, but we hate how scary it can be online these days when you're surfing without any kind of privacy. That's why Surfshark VPN keeps you safe and private by masking everything you do online. Encrypted data and IP addresses that let you travel the world without geo-restrictions. And sure, it's cool to browse services like Netflix outside of your country, but for me, it's the way Surfshark keeps me and my data safe online. Plus, you can access even greater security with their antivirus and data breach alert features. So whether you're streaming, shopping, or just trying to do work that will horrify people around the world, you'll love the way Surfshark enhances your online experience. So do what I did. Secure your privacy with Surfshark. Enter coupon code NOSLEEPPOD for an extra 3 months free at surfshark.deals/NOSLEEPPOD. You heard me right. 3 extra months for free. That's surfshark.deals/NOSLEEPPOD. And now, back to the campfire. We've got something to get off our chest. Sometimes, no matter how good your intentions are, things take an unexpected turn into the darkness. Just ask Mark, who set out to do good and ended up having to tell us where it all went wrong. And in this tale, shared with us by author C. Lenz, we hear Mark tell us that after all these things that I've done, sometimes the guilt is overwhelming for everyone. Performing this tale is Jeff Clement. So, they say the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I'm sure Mark will agree, as he shares the confession.
My name is Mark Dunn. I live in apartment 102, 23... Oh, you just need me to say my name. Okay. And the confession. Right. Well, like I said, you're gonna be disappointed. I'm gonna confess, but not to murder. What happened was, I guess you'd say, an accident. It was... I'm not sure how to describe it. I mean, I didn't mean for it to happen. Hell, I called the ambulance. Right. Fine. I'll just start at the beginning. I broke into Gerald Sharp's suite pretty easily. Hotels don't really pay that much attention to who comes and goes and who's on what floor. And those card readers they have, they aren't super secure. It was a huge suite, and it didn't look like Sharp was using most of the rooms. So I hid in one of the ones without any luggage or anything until he was back and waited until he went to sleep. I had a knife because I figured it would be more intimidating. I wasn't planning on killing him, but a knife looks like you're planning on keeping it quiet and getting away with it. Huh? No. Obviously, I didn't have a personal connection with Gerald Sharp. Does it look like we'd hang out? Well, yeah, of course, I knew of him. Don't you? You know how I knew of him. Do I really need to tell you? From the news, jeez. His company bought a patent for an HIV medication and upped the price by 6,000% so that now anyone living with HIV can't afford to, you know, live. No, I don't think he deserved to die for that. Not really. No, I didn't. even if he was killing people, like, actively, at all times. You ever heard that hypothetical question about whether you'd push a button for $1 million, but one random person who you'd never met will die? Yeah, well, like that Cameron Diaz movie. It was a Twilight Zone episode first, you know. Whatever. It doesn't matter. Would you press it? It doesn't matter. Your answer is going to be yes or no. Any normal, healthy human's answer is going to be yes or no. What it's not the fuck going to be is to sit in front of the button and wail on it nonstop all day, every day. But that's what Sharp was doing. What? No, I told you, I don't think he deserved to die. Well, maybe a little, but not enough to actually do it. I didn't go there to kill him. Come to think of it, is he even dead? He was still breathing when I called 911. Hell, he was still standing, and I don't know if doing that would kill you. Died in the ambulance. Fuck. Like I said, I didn't murder him. And don't give me any of that manslaughter bullshit either. He did it to himself. All I did was give him the spiked water. I figured you guys would have known about that by now. I guess you haven't had a chance to check his blood yet. Alright. So, after I broke in, I forced him to drink a bottle of water that I dissolved acid and ecstasy into beforehand. Why? Because I didn't want to get caught blatantly carrying a bunch of drugs. Oh, why the drugs? Okay, so have you ever heard that story about the libertarian who took ecstasy for the first time, realized other people had emotions, and totally changed his beliefs? Well, I thought maybe it would work on Sharp. The LSD was to try to boost the effects and maybe cover my ass if he made a statement to the police. You know, there was a study once where they gave half the participants $5 and gave the control group nothing, then told them they could either split another $5 with someone else — it was an actor, but they thought it was another test participant — or keep all the money. You know who agreed to split it? The control group. The ones who'd already been given $5 kept the other $5 for themselves. I swear to God, money breaks your brain. If $5 can do that to you, can you imagine what it's like to be a millionaire? Or a billionaire? Wealth is a mental illness. Fuck you, jealousy. Yeah, I wish I had $1 million, so does everyone, but I'm not jealous of a sick fuck like Sharp. What would you do with $1 million? Or whatever amount no one could ever spend in their lifetime, no matter how hard they tried. Probably like 100 mil. No, come on. I'm trying to prove a point. Retire to the Bahamas? Damn, that sounds nice. You? Travel? Nice. I'd quit my job, but I'd like to think I'd also start an animal shelter. I've always fostered pets, but I've only ever had the money to do one at a time. And yeah, I'd basically pay everyone else to do all the actual work, but, you know, it's still some good in the world. But I get it when people say they'd start a business. You know, the people who want to design clothes or own an art gallery or do something for love that they never had a shot at until they weren't one paycheck from starving. I get it. What I don't get, and what you guys and I would never do with $100 million, is spend all our time hanging out with politicians, trying to make sure that that number never has to go down. We only have a limited amount of time on Earth, no matter how much money we have. Why would we waste it on making a number go up, once the number's already big enough that we can't hope to use it all? No, I'm serious. Doesn't that sound sick? Like, actually, mentally, unwell. Like, what kind of intense distress could compel you to spend all your time in a boardroom with other old rich fucks instead of on a beach? Would you even want to talk to one of those diaper-wearing geezers in Congress for a second, let alone go to lunch with them? I mean, there's something seriously wrong with dudes like Gerald Sharp. Okay, yeah, if I got rich, I'd probably end up doing the same thing. That's the point. If I did heroin for a week, I'd be addicted to that, too. But that's not an argument for heroin. Fair enough. I'm stalling. What can I say? I don't want to relive it. You saw what happened. Well, actually, if you just saw the aftermath, hey, you guys probably have no idea what happened. So I forced Sharp to drink the entire water bottle, watched to make sure he swallowed, and then I duct taped him to a chair. Taped his mouth shut, too, so he couldn't scream for help or try to throw up. And then I left the room for an hour. To let the drugs kick in, obviously. And to get him good and scared. I did leave him with a really vague threat about him paying for his crimes. I wanted him thinking about what he'd done for this to happen to him. What I might do to him. Whether he'd maybe hurt one of my loved ones. You know, just sitting there, stewing. I was trying to give him the mother of all long midnights of the soul. So I figured he needed some time for the uncertainty to really amp him up. When I came back, his pupils were huge. I showed him the knife, told him not to scream, and ripped the duct tape off. I could tell he was high as hell, because he wouldn't stop babbling. But it was all in this super exaggerated whisper. Like he had no idea what his real volume was at. I figured, better he's not being loud. Cut the tape off his arms and legs and shoved him into the bathroom. I made him look into the mirror. And then I said, well, I don't remember exactly, but pretty much what I've been saying to you guys about him. Some stuff about how he had cut himself off from humanity in order to profit off of death because he couldn't do that while feeling empathy for his victims. I told him that the process was reciprocal, and it was why no normal human could feel empathy for him anymore. And then I told him that he had two choices. Either look at himself in the mirror and fully accept what he'd done, or eat it. No, not like eat it, like die. Eat the mirror. Although, I guess I can see why you'd be confused. And that was it. I didn't do anything else to him. That was when I left. Or at least tried to. Fine, I'll tell you what happened next. But you better get me a court-appointed psychiatrist or something. Because I never want to have to describe this again. Unless it's to a professional. Okay. So, I'm backing out of the bathroom. Making sure Sharp keeps his eyes on the mirror. I know it's mean to give someone a bunch of drugs and then have them look at themselves in the mirror, but like I said, I was trying to give him a long, dark midnight of the soul. That, and I didn't want him to try to call for help before I was gone. I reached the doorway and turned to go. Sharp's already crying, so I figure I have a bunch of time to get out of there. But the second I look away, I hear a thud. I look back, and Sharp is punching the mirror over and over. Just hitting the same spot until it starts cracking. His hands all cut up, and parts of the glass are falling into the sink, and he's just sobbing, like, about how this is impossible, and how can I expect him to eat a mirror and stuff. And I'm just standing there, like, dude, you're missing the point, but I don't even know if you can hear me. He's just scraping shards of the glass out of the wall, slicing his hands open, begging me to let him stop. And I'm screaming back about how he can stop, how it's okay. I don't want to do anything to him. But he starts pounding on the glass on the counter, like he's trying to crush it up really fine. Like he thinks that maybe if it's a powder, he can swallow it. I think he tried to. It was hard to tell, because the bits of glass were all mixed with his blood, and it looked thick and chunky, but maybe that's just what happens when you're smearing blood everywhere. But he gathered up like a glob of something and shoved it in his mouth and forced himself to swallow. There was blood all over his face. God, I don't know if it was from his hand or the scraped shards of glass over his skin when he rubbed his hand over his mouth, but he looked like a mess. And then he picks up this one shard. It was long, but thin. Like about the size and shape of a finger. I don't know why he thought he could. Maybe he thought he could just slide it down his throat? Fuck, I have no idea. I'm like begging him not to do it at this point. I toss the knife onto the ground right next to his feet so he knows I'm not a threat anymore, so that he could threaten me if he wanted it. Oh, God. There was already so much blood dripping down from the sink, from his hands, from his face. God, I can still see the knife just landing in that puddle. He opens his mouth and puts that shard in. Holy Christ, I couldn't watch. That was when I got out of there and I called you guys. I could have left, you know. The whole time I was on the phone, I could hear his gagging and sobbing and all this fucking gurgling. And I still had to listen to that while I was waiting for the ambulance to show up. Jesus Christ. All I wanted was for him to feel all the guilt he truly deserves to feel. But I guess he wasn't built to handle it. I wonder if anyone is.
I confess, we have just a short word from our sponsor. For ad-free, extended horror content, go to sleepless.thenosleeppodcast.com. I should confess something as well. I don't have a head for financial stuff. I struggle to find time to do my finances when there's so much horrifying audio to produce. That's why I'm glad I have Rocket Money to help. Rocket Money makes it so easy to budget all of my expenses and even helps me get rid of unwanted subscriptions. You see, Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. I love how the dashboard shows me this month's spending compared to last month, so I can clearly see my spending habits. Plus, they'll help me create a custom budget and keep my spending on track. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/nosleep. Look after your hard-earned money by going to rocketmoney.com/nosleep. Now let's return to the campfire. Keep your eyes open for this next story. It can be chilling to hear a serial killer being interviewed about their crimes. You can watch them on many documentaries as they sit there, usually without much compunction, telling us why they did what they did to all those victims. And in this tale, shared with us by author M. Scott, we meet an uncommon kind of serial killer. A woman who explains why she did what she did. Performing this tale is Aaron Lillis. So when you're out in public, smile like you mean it. You never know if you're going to encounter a killer who is asking you to see me.
When I was a kid, I woke up early every Saturday morning to tune into my favorite TV show, the name of which I have been told to withhold. It was 1986 and I was 5 years old. My younger brother and I would scurry down the stairs and plop in front of our large color TV set. I excitedly pressed the buttons on the TV until it reached channel 25 and, armed with a bowl of cereal, we waited with bated breath as the opening credits to began. We sang along in tandem, smiles as wide as our ears, belting out each and every note, creating a cacophony of joyful sound. After the opening song sequence, we sat silently relishing every colorful scene, the silence only ever being broken by intermittent giggles. As the show was about to end, my heart would always begin to beat faster in anticipation of my absolute favorite part of the show. You see, at the end of this show, the beautiful lady would hold up a magic mirror. This mirror would allow her to see the children who were watching the show. She would call out a handful of names each episode, pointing and telling the viewers who she saw. I see Michael, I see Katie, I see Timmy, I see Pam. You get the idea. Adrenaline washed over me every single time she held that mirror because I knew that today was going to be the day when she would see me. So that is how it would go every Saturday for 2 years. I would eagerly wait each episode for her to call my name, for her to see me. And every Saturday I would taste the bitterness of rejection as she failed to call my name, as she failed to see me. The first year I began watching the show, I would get over this indignation rather quickly, usually just stomping my feet and declaring that she did not call my name again. But after a while, my reactions began to become more severe. Stomping turned to throwing things turned to screaming, screaming turned into smacking my brother in the face. That was the final straw, of course. I lost TV privileges for 2 weeks, and my mother forbade me to watch that show ever again. How could my mother know that at that time that her punishment came too late? How could she have realized that something had splintered in her child? Something had broken beyond repair? How would she have attempted to change things if she had the foresight to know that this TV show that she had forbidden me to see had already fractured part of me that would lead to what the papers referred to as horrific events 15 years later? You see, I believe that during those formative years, the years where life events mold minds like clay, the rejection I felt bled through to all areas of my life like melted butter filtering its way into every nook and cranny of my being. That bitch on the show never saw me. And soon after that, my father left us to be with a new family. My mother blamed me. I know she did. After the surges of my outbursts intensified, I would hear my parents arguing about me night after night. When my grades at school started to decline, I heard each parent blaming the other for my behavior. With each argument, the barbed insults that they hurled toward each other shot closer to their mark. It was not a slow death, as it only took 6 months from that point for my parents to pull the plug on their marriage. and on me. After he finally left, the dark void inside me began to fester. The now empty husk that I called mother effectively maintained a blunt effect, greeting me with only a few and fleeting superficial smiles. Those days, the only time she ever glanced at me was through the lens of her empty wine glass. School afforded me no sanctuary, as I was all but invisible there, too. Sitting alone at the lunch table, watching the little whores talk about their boyfriends and their makeup or whatever douche boy band was coming to town. They barely glanced my way, and when they did, they were looking through me. I was never invited to any parties, not that I had wanted to go. I traversed the treachery of high school for 2 years before I finally dropped out. My mother had checked out so completely, at this point, she barely raised her head to siphon the fluid from her bottle of Jack. So it did not surprise me that she took no notice of my full-time truancy from academia. This cult of isolation of which I was the sole member continued as I myopically navigated into adulthood. The menial job that I obtained shortly after I dropped out continued to cultivate the abhorrent isolation that had always been my single constant companion. I was never chosen for Employee of the Month. I was overlooked for every promotion despite my seniority. I had utterly been forced to remain in this existence of singularity, day in and day out. I tried online dating. I'm human, despite the newspapers making contrary assessments. I do have certain basic human needs that had up to this point never been met. There would be no eHarmony matches for me, no walks on the beach or running slow motion in the rain. Don't get me wrong, there was running, and it was always done by my date before the first course had time to digest. What did you say? Don't you dare interrupt me! I will get to the gory details. Don't worry about that. Don't you know I realize that is why you came? To hear about the slaughter, the guts, the play-by-play of every extraction. I came here willingly, agreeing to this interview. I expect you to have the patience to allow me a bit of digression. How can you understand what I did if you cannot understand why I did it? Now, where was I? Yes, well, when you become invisible to the world, you find comfort where you can find it. For me, I discovered it with true crime. A completely innocent diversion for most. I'm most certainly not alone in this, as evidenced by the number of true crime television programs and podcasts. Is this interview not being used for readers of true crime? Anyway, I would pore over books about Bundy and Gain. You know, all the truly interesting ones. BTK, Dahmer, Chikatilo. I read about them all. I wouldn't say I felt a connection to any of them, but I felt a sense of understanding with some. You see, I believe that when you are forced to lurk in the shadows for so long, it makes sense that after a while you begin to adapt to the darkness. This, I believe, is where we get to what you have less than patiently been waiting for. Before we get to the main course, I would like to preface it by saying that while most people try to put me in the same category as the serial killers I mentioned, that would be a mistake. First off, the media loves referring to me as a sociopath. This is slander, to say the least. Or is it libel? Either way, this representation is fraught with inaccuracy. Most of those serial killers showed signs in early childhood. I had a bit of a temper that gave way to introversion over the years, but I never set shit on fire or tortured animals. In fact, I rather love animals. I have a cat at home. I always adored little Romper. Wouldn't dream of harming him. Another important thing that distinguishes me from the psychopath that you would love to categorize me with is that I feel remorse for what I have done. I mean, do you honestly think I want to be locked up in a 5x5 for the rest of my life, as short as it may be, thanks to the state? So no, not a sociopath. Now that I have that cleared up, let's talk about my first time, shall we? That is what you really want to hear, right? Oh, let me see. Yeah, it was a cold fall night in October 2001, 2 days before Halloween. Not that Halloween has anything to do with it. It was about 10:26 p.m. on the number 7 bus leaving work in the direction of home, if you can call a rat-infested one-bedroom studio a home. It was not an unusual night, not a particularly bad or good night, just another routine ride on public transportation, as if I ever had a chance in hell of getting a vehicle of my own. I was in my usual seat, minding my own business, as I always did. My eyes were stuck within the confines of a Stephen King novel, matter of fact. Couldn't tell you which one. Oh, Carrie. I was definitely reading Carrie. Oh, how the sweet memories come flooding back to me now. As I said, I was reading Carrie, and I was engrossed in it. It is one of my favorites. They're all gonna laugh at you. Laugh at you indeed, Carrie. So I am reading, and the bus stopped. I instinctively looked up as I knew my stop was coming up soon, but almost simultaneously returned to my book, realizing that I was 2 stops yet from my apartment building. I barely noticed the man that walked onto the bus. I will, of course, never forget him. After all, you never forget your first. This man, who police were eventually and painstakingly able to identify as Steve Blake, walked onto the bus. As he passed by me, I heard shuffled, heavy footsteps, but it was not until I felt a steel-toed boot push hard against my unexpecting foot that I looked up at him for the first time. And as you know, certainly won't be the last time. I remember wincing and the kind of pain that shoots through you like lightning, so fast that it takes moments for your throat to vocalize that pain. But as the yelp of momentary debilitation escaped my lips, Stevie Boy only half glanced at me and disingenuously said, "Sorry, I didn't see ya." I mean, he had caused me bodily harm, and I didn't even register enough for him to look at me. And I swear to all that is holy, I saw that Lord and Vuce fuck smile. The hot rage boiling up inside caused acrid bile to coat my tongue. I felt anger coursing from my feet to my chest. I know that anyone sitting by me could feel the heat emanating from my body. I remember shaking, breathing heavy as small beads of sweat formed on my brow. I felt years of being overlooked and ignored going from a simmer to a rolling boil, and I was moments from losing my shit right then and there. But you know what? I didn't. Instead, the strangest thing happened. An ethereal calm came over me, and for the first time in my life, I felt a sense of purpose. I knew exactly what had to be done. I missed my bus that night. I waited. I waited for Stevie Boy to get off the bus And I was praying. Yes, praying to God that he was getting off alone. As the fates aligned, Stevie Boy did get off all by his lonesome, and as if all the gods were smiling down on me, there was no one outside of the dark bus stop. Steve exited the bus, I behind him. And wouldn't you know it, he never even noticed me. Of course he didn't. I didn't know at the time exactly what I was going to do to Stevie, but I knew it would have to be done in a place where I could take my time. He walked up to this tiny, what they call shotgun, home. There were no cars in the driveway. And at that point, I don't think I would have stopped, even if there had been. I could be into the group thing. As he started to climb the almost dilapidated stairs to get to his shanty, I noticed that he was less than steady on his feet. It was then that my nostrils picked up on the stale beer that wafted from his greasy pores. I stood behind him silently, yet so close that I just knew he would feel my breath. But the booze had been successful in deactivating his spider senses. I did a quick survey of the porch to see if there was an object that I could use to incapacitate him. In my mind, I half expected to see a banjo next to a rocking chair. But instead, it was a heavy planter filled with weeds that caught my eye. As Stevie Boy unlocked his door, I simultaneously grabbed that planter and smashed it hard against his balding scalp. He stumbled a few feet in the house, completely clear in the entryway. He was making this too easy. He was all but inviting me in. A shudder trickled down my spine, and I held back a fearful breath. It wasn't fear from getting caught, but rather that I may have already killed that fucker before I had a chance to gut him. If that was indeed what I had intended to do. Just a friendly reminder that this was not premeditated. My narrow fingers navigated through the folds of his thick neck to feel for a pulse. After pressing through layers of fat, I found it, and it was surprisingly strong, and I remember bursting out in cathartic laughter, but quickly got a hold of myself. After all, I had work to do. I dragged his ass into the small kitchen to the right. Although he was more than a few whoppers bigger than me, I was able to move him quite effortlessly. Looking back, it must have been all that adrenaline pumping through me. Kind of like those mothers who lift heavy cars off their kids. Logic prevailed over emotion at that moment, and I left him lying on the floor to do a quick perimeter search. I couldn't be certain he lived alone. Was an educated guess, judging by his bulging midsection and unkempt hair, unruly beard, and the fact that he smelled as if he'd been baptized in Budweiser, I surmised it was a safe bet. After confirming this fact, I returned to the kitchen to mentally sketch out a plan. Table for two, please. I started to rifle through the house in search of something to tie him up with. Moments later, I retrieved several lengths of extension cords that were used to connect his ancient TV to the wall. I tied his hands together tightly first. The way they dug into his wrists reminded me of the cartoons where the dog has the long rope of sausages. Next, I tied his legs, and again with less effort than I anticipated, I was able to get him up into one of the kitchen chairs. He was now snugly propped between the table and the wall. I sat across from his unconscious form, anticipating the moment he woke up and saw me. The moment reminded me of my childhood as I waited for that bitch to look in the mirror and call my name. But this time would be different. This time I knew that I would be seen. Watching and waiting, it was so quiet that I could hear the second hand of a nearby clock moving in tandem with my heartbeat. It was in that moment I realized that my stomach was also audible. Since it seemed that he would not be returning to consciousness in the next few moments, I decided to do some reconnaissance in the refrigerator. After all, I would surely need my strength. My expectations were low as to what I would find in the refrigerator, and for the most part, I was correct in this assertion. Two cans of what was probably a six-pack this morning, some half-empty condiment jars, and a box of pizza. I grabbed the box from the fridge and lifted the top to reveal two slices of what seemed to be pepperoni pizza. Perhaps against my better judgment, I popped a slice into Stevie Boy's microwave. As the seconds ticked away on his antiquated cooking appliance, it occurred to me that I had no tools. Though I had not fully mapped out what I was going to do to Stevie, I knew it would require an instrument to do it. So I scavenged in the drawers of the kitchen, looking for something that would serve a purpose. I was at first disappointed to find only a single dull steak knife that he had certainly pilfered from some truck stop diner. My disappointment quickly gave way to excitement once more as I realized the dullness of the blade. While causing more elbow grease on my part, would also mean more pain for good old Stevie Boy. I was jostled out of my reverie by the sound of the micro oven beeping. I quickly glanced over at Stevie Boy, hoping the sound may have roused him from his slumber. But alas, it had not. I sat across from him once more, taking a bite of the pizza. I remember thinking that for leftover pizza, it was quite delicious. I instinctively looked at the box again to file the name into my long-term memory. Mama Joe's Pizza. It really is good. Point of fact, I would frequent Mama Joe's multiple occasions over the next few weeks. The taste of it always filled me with erotic nostalgia of my first time with Stevie Boy. As he continued to drift within the confines of unconsciousness, I savored each bite of pizza. But at that moment, my gratification did not come from the taste of the slice, but rather from the thoughts that undulated across my mind. I began to imagine what I would do when he woke up. What I would say. For some reason, I had a fleeting thought of Hannibal Lecter as he brilliantly served justice with just the right amount of seasoning. I, of course, had no interest in devouring human flesh. I'm not crazy, let me remind you. But the thought of Stevie Boy hanging on a hook with his ribs exposed like a rack of lamb made me chuckle a bit, if I'm to be honest. So there I was, salivating over what I would do, when finally I heard the sound of a steel-toed boot shuffling against the worn tiled floor. My heart began to pump blood furiously through my body as he slowly opened blackened eyes that were virtually swollen shut. At that moment, he resembled a raccoon. And I almost felt pity for him. But he wasn't a raccoon, and I didn't feel sorry. It was obvious he had not completely grasped what was happening to him. Probably felt like he had just woken up from a nightmare. But as his eyes adjusted to the light, his face reflected pure terror as he, for the first time, gazed upon me. He looked at me square in my eyes. And I have to be honest, it felt good. He gurgled out some version of the English language, but had not yet found coherence. As he blinked away a bit of the grog, he was able to weakly utter, "Who are you? What do you want from me?" Hearing the pure terror in a voice that was at least 2 octaves above the sorry he uttered on the bus, made the hairs on my arms and neck stand attention. I wanted this moment to last as long as possible. So I got up from my chair and walked in deliberation towards him. Looking back, I'm sure my toothy grin must have been unsettling to him, but it could not be helped. I smiled so big, my teeth felt cold as my tongue lapped slowly against them. I began circling him like a crow to carrion, tapping a dull knife against my sleeve as I did. In retrospect, this may have been a bit dramatic, but you have to understand, for the first time in my life, I had a captive audience. For 5 minutes or so, this is what I did. And with each pass, I noticed another dollop of sweat formulating on his now beet red forehead. When I finally opened my mouth to speak, the pungent smell of urine permeated my nostrils. The clown pissed himself. The sounds of his squeals were intoxicating. "Can you see me now?" I taunted as I used the knife to snap off one of his buttons. I repeated this as I popped each button off his dirty, sweat-saturated flannel. I took the tip of the knife and gently slid it down the side of his face. Not enough to make a cut, mind you. I simply wanted him to feel the coolness of the blade against his skin. I noticed that his chest began to rise faster and faster, in tandem with my own heartbeat. The synchronicity of this was exhilarating, and I became so excited that I had not noticed I started to cut into the flesh of his cheek ever so slightly. I stopped myself, because I had already decided I did not want to cut just yet. I positioned my face so close to his that I could smell his acrid sweat. I whispered in his ear,
"Please don't break my heart and tell me that you don't remember me, darling."
Stevie looked up at me sheepishly and bleated, "I don't know. I can't. I don't." Frustrated by his incoherent utterances, I removed his boot and stomped on his foot as hard as I could. I stomped 2 or 3 times more until I could feel the crackle of displaced bone under my feet. Then I got close to him once more and whispered,
"Do you see me now? Because you certainly could not be bothered on the bus when you crushed my foot."
I don't know if it was a look of confusion, fear, or shock, but with it came his squealed response. You mean you have me here because I stepped on your foot? Wrong answer. Without thinking, I plunged the dull knife with all the force that I could muster into his gullet.
His disregard for others sickens me. Everything about you sickens me. You literally walk over people while you live your life like an indulgent, lush of a pig.
This is what I said as I plunged my dagger over and over into his torso. Until the last time when I thrust it upward and twisted, knowing this would be the final blow. The kitchen blade inched deeper into what I imagined to be his spleen. Maybe his liver. I never studied anatomy, but I know the dull blade had pierced something in his gullet. I could almost feel the organ burst as I dug deeper and deeper, whispering in his ear.
Do you see me? Do you see me?
As the warm blood coated my hand, I realized this would be my glorious reincarnation. As his life was being extinguished, mine was replenished. When it became apparent that his light had been snuffed out, I noticed his eyes remained open. I kneeled over him one more time and whispered,
"Do you see me now?"
This sent me into a fit of uncontrollable laughter at the irony of it. I repeated it over and over again, reminiscent of the Jack Nicholson Joker.
"Do you see me now? Do you see me now? Do you see me now?"
Blankness of his stare is what inspired what the media would refer to as my calling card. I decided I needed to take something of his that would remind me of our intimate moment. What better token to take with me than an eye or two to force him to look upon me whenever I wanted? I quickly began formulating hypotheses as how best to remove them. It's not like I had planned this ahead of time, and it's not like I could go on YouTube to look up the best ways to extract someone's eyeballs. I first tried to catalog a list of tools that would probably be the best to use. A knife, especially the dull one I had, would be too clumsy. I immediately thought a melon baller would most likely yield the results I was looking for. What were the chances that a slob such as Stevie Boy would have something as refined as a melon baller? I began rifling through his drawers to find something that I could use. It came up empty. I resigned myself to the fact that I would have to use the dull knife that I had used to cut this pig. I took a deep breath and realized that I was nervous. Not from the impending act itself. It was more out of fear of damaging the goods too much. I used my fingers to open his right eyelid as far as I could. I gently inserted my knife under what I believed to be the bottom of his eyeball. Eyeballs were bigger than I thought, and I ended up piercing it. Cloudy, blood-streaked liquid oozed from his lower eyelid. I readjusted the knife, going lower and deeper into the socket. I lifted my knife up and pierced the eye again. Then it hit me. I'm not a surgeon, and this does not have to be done with such precision. I would cut around the eye until I got to the bone. That way I could see how best to remove those eyes. It's not like he had to look pretty. No hot dates in the near future. Not that he had any dates that didn't come with a price tag and a pimp. So that's what I did. I hacked away at his flesh until pink casing turned to red meat, and until red meat turned to blood-tinged bone. I was reminded of the movie Jeepers Creepers. How'd that song go? Oh yeah, Jeepers Creepers. Where'd you get those peepers? Jeepers Creepers. Where'd you get those eyes? I hadn't realized it, but I was humming that song during the whole extraction. Laughing after I hummed the part that asked, where'd you get those eyes? In short, I was able to remove both eyes, despite the bluntness of my tool. They aren't the prettiest of my trophies, but they were my firsts. And like a five-year-old showing a painting to their parents, I held his eyes up by the nerve and stared in admiration at the work I had done, and I was completely satisfied. I suspect I would have smoked a cigarette at that moment if I had one. I was ready to leave old Stevie's hovel. Soup to nuts, I had been in his house for just under 2 hours, and it was damn near 1 a.m. when I felt ready to leave. I didn't worry about forensic evidence. Of course, I wasn't in the system. I was invisible, a ghost. And ghosts didn't leave behind evidence. As I got ready to walk out the door, another brilliant thought flashed through my brain. I didn't want people to think this was some thoughtless act. People would need to know the reason this piggy had to go to market. So I left a little clue. This would, of course, become another one of my signatures. I wriggled two fingers into the sockets of where Stevie Boy's eyes had once called home, and dug until I had enough paint on my fingers to write the words, "Do you see me now?" on the wall behind his lifeless tub of meat. I wiped my fingers on the tattered remains of his flannel and laughed once more as I looked back at my work with pride. I closed the front door behind me and walked home, whistling Jeepers Creepers the whole way. Well, that was how it all began. I went home that night and slept like a fucking baby. I had never felt so free. My experience with Stevie Boy had given me such a high that inevitably there came the crash, and like any addict, I sought to recreate the feelings of that first hit. I wasn't sure what the news would say about what had transpired between Stevie Boy and myself. But much to my chagrin, it took 4 days before my artwork had been discovered. I guess Stevie Boy was more of a loser than I thought. According to the news report, it had been a wellness check after Stevie Boy had not shown up to work. The reporters immediately branded me a sociopath. One reporter had a psychologist on his show analyzing me. What the heck? He said that I was most likely a 30 to 35-year-old impotent male, even went on to say something about incest. How could this guy misread me to this extent? It was clear he couldn't see me. You know what? He couldn't see me at all. But I promise you, at the end, he did. They all did, in the end. I hope that after our time together, that you see me.
and the light of dawn approaches. Our tales must come to an end until the next time we gather. We'll keep the fire burning until you return. That is, if you dare to remain sleepless. The No Sleep Podcast is presented by Creative Reason Media. The musical score was composed by Brandon Boone. Our production team is Phil Mikulski, Jeff Clement, and Jesse Cornett. Our editor-in-chief is Jessica McAvoy. To discover how you can get even more sleepless horror stories from us, just visit sleepless.thenosleeppodcast.com to learn about the Sleepless Sanctuary. Ad-free extended episodes each week, and lots of bonus content for the dark hours, all for only one low monthly price. On behalf of everyone at the No Sleep Podcast, we thank you for joining us around the campfire for our 20th season. This audio program is copyright 2023 and 2024 by Creative Reason Media, Inc. All rights reserved. The copyrights for each story are held by the respective authors. No duplication or reproduction of this audio program is permitted without the written consent of Creative Reason Media, Inc.